My name is Ronis Darrell, and I did 8 years for a crime that I didn't commit. I did 8 years in prison and 6.5 years on parole.
Hi, you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast about wrongful convictions and problems in the justice system. I'm DeMarco, and I'm here with, I'm all alone. Actually, I'm here with our producer, Lisa. Brooke is under doctor's orders to stop talking so much, for a little bit anyway. She injured the joints in her jaw. She's doing well, though we know it's hard for Brooke to not talk as much as she would like. She is still going to join us for the sponsors. We have three sponsors this week: Home Chef, Songfinch, and Pitney Bowes. Look, there's Brooke now.
Hey, friend. I am happy to take a break from taking a break to tell you about my favorite new meal delivery service, Home Chef. When I see the delivery person bringing my Home Chef box, I get so excited. And to be honest, I think my neighbor in the apartment across the hall is just as excited because he knows I'm going to share. I like to cook, but sometimes it's hard to find the time to go shopping and prep everything. So now I get to enjoy, without the hassle, Home Chef. They have 15 dinners to choose from each week. That means I get to cook and enjoy real, delicious foods that are simple but full of flavor in around 30 minutes. My neighbor and I agree that our favorite meal so far has been Italian sausage and butternut farfalle. You know, bow tie noodles.
Let me get this straight. There's a ton of choices of real classic dishes that even the kids will eat.
There's so many options sometimes, it's hard to decide what to choose next. I love that there's not restrictions on the combinations of foods you can choose. When it's time to choose, I get excited to discover new favorites. Plus, I know I'm not ruining my budget because each meal is less than $10 per serving.
So everything you need to cook an incredible meal is delivered right to your door. You don't have to go to the grocery store at all, and the meals cost less than $10 per serving.
You got it. Home Chef makes preparing the meals super easy by delivering fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients to my door. They're easy to prepare and come with a picture recipe card. Home Chef makes sitting down to a healthy home-cooked meal the highlight of my day.
I am so ready. How do I sign up for this?
Visit homechef.com/actual and enter actual at checkout for $30 off your first order. So remember, that's two times you have to enter the code. Visit homechef.com/actual and then enter actual again when you check out for $30 off your first order.
Save $30 on your first order with promo code actual at homechef.com/actual.
At this point, at least for the next few weeks, I'd have to go back to voice rest and let you carry on with the rest of the episode. However, today, I have a surprise for you. So I think I'm going to stick around for a few more minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yes, it is.
So what if I do one listener swag challenge and then I can give you your surprise?
Oh yeah, I love swag and I love surprises, so let's hear it.
Here's the challenge. I've just met an exoneree from Michigan, and there's a book written about his experience. Like many exonerees, he wants to use the hand life dealt him to help others. He's trying to understand the power of podcasting. So this is my request. I would like for you to email him to share with him some of the things you share with me, like how you're now volunteering, or how you've decided to go to law school, or how you feel like you've become an advocate. Just anything that you have done to change your life and become an advocate because of podcasting. I get so many encouraging letters, and he would really like to hear those things as well. So the letters can be sent to Kenny@actualinpod.com. That's Kenny@actualinpod.com. So if you send Kenny an email with how podcasting has affected your life and your involvement in helping the justice system, I will send you an envelope with four stickers, one from each podcast that is recorded in my closet. If you already have that, let me know and we'll figure out a different swag. So this is the tricky part. You don't have to share your letter to Kenny with me because that's personal. If you could, however, after you've sent it, screenshot just the top part where the to, from, subject, and date lines are, and then email it to me. It has to be email, and remember to let me know the address I need to send it to. The email is actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. I'm going to mail the swag out on May 14th, so I'll need to have your screenshot by the 13th. Okay, DeMarco, are you ready for your surprise?
Yes, I sure am.
So, this surprise came from a sponsor. And we don't usually do two sponsors this close together in an episode. I promise, though, you will enjoy this one. I was so excited about it that I didn't want to put it mid-interview as a distraction.
Wow, your major excitement is making me excited.
The sponsor is called Songfinch, and they're great. Okay, DeMarco, I'm texting you a link so you can follow along. Ready?
Yes.
Listeners, I'm going to share with you how you can follow along as well in just a minute. But first, here comes a little part of the surprise.
He's the king of Oklahoma, even cooler than Safari Joe. He's a little bit OCD, but that's the very thing that helps our podcast grow. He's got a smile that's contagious and leave you bursting at the seams. And if you ever get the chance to meet him, you'll see exactly what I mean.
That, my friends, was a clip from a song named DeMarco. Songfinch, besides being one of my new favorite sponsors, will write a customized song for you. Because I knew Buried Alive is getting ready to premiere, I wanted to get you something special. What do you think?
That's so incredible, Brooke. I love it. It's great that my song has its own webpage where I can read the lyrics and download it so I can add it to my playlist. Yes!
Listeners, you can do that too. You can listen to DeMarco's entire song and see the lyrics and download it by clicking on the link in the show notes or by texting D song, the letter D, no space, combined with the word song, to 797979.
I can think of so many people I'm going to use this for. Weddings, anniversaries, birthday.
It starts at just $100 and it's delivered within a week. As a person who buys music frequently, that's an incredible deal. Fortunately, we also have a promo code. Use promo code ACTUAL when you order and save 10% off your personalized song from scratch.
Are you serious? That's such a great deal. $99 for a personalized song using the foundation option. Plus, if you choose to have your song made from scratch, you get 10% off when you use the promo code ACTUAL.
Having DeMarco's song created was fun and easy. I just visited www.songfinch.com, chose start your song, and then when it was time, I entered code ACTUAL, and to their word, the song was ready in less than a week.
Visit songfinch.com and use promo code ACTUAL for your personalized song. Be sure to keep listening because we are going to play my full song at the end of the episode.
Remember, use promo code ACTUAL for 10% off your personalized song made from scratch. Okay, back to mouth rest. I'll see you later for the last sponsor.
Yeah, I met Rodnus in Memphis, and I was troubled that there was no type of publicity or articles or news about his case, so it was hard to look up. But, you know, me and him hit it off. He's a good guy, and he was way from Hawaii, which I got mixed up with Alaska, but, you know, Rodnus is a good dude, and I'm going to keep in touch with him. But here's Rodnus, y'all.
Growing up, you know, it was me, my mom, my stepdad. I had three sisters. I have two now, and I have a younger brother. You know, my stepfather, he's a detective, and then he became a prison guard. So, you know, my life was, you know, the average teenage life in, you know, the streets. You see the struggles, but we had a family unit. We had love. We had all that stuff growing up. So coming up, you know, I wanted to be a police officer because my stepfather was in law enforcement. So when I graduated, I ended up joining the Navy at the age of 17 in the delayed entry program.
I want to go back some. So where were you born?
I was born in Louisiana, Bogalusa, Louisiana. It's a small town about an hour and a half outside of New Orleans.
And how did you get to Hawaii?
The Navy. I joined the Navy when I was 17. And because I was in the 11th grade, I couldn't officially go until I graduated. So after I graduated at 18, I joined the Navy, and fortune would have it, I was on a pre-com ship, and it was stationed in Hawaii. So that's how I ended up here. but I decided to stay once I got here.
Where were you living when you decided to join the Navy?
I was in Bogalusa, Louisiana. Like I said, it was about an hour and a half outside of New Orleans. I was in the 11th grade and decided, I didn't really decide to join the Navy. The Navy recruiter just happened to call me when I was home, and I was like, yeah, I take a test, and I passed the test, and he said, you know, you could join the Navy when you graduate. And he put me in the delayed entry program. And after I graduated, I decided that the Navy was the best choice for me at that time.
Okay. Did you have a big family?
Yes, my family was pretty big. Yeah, I grew up with four other siblings. I had three older sisters and a younger brother. And, you know, cousin and auntie, uncle. So we had a pretty big family.
Were y'all close?
We was real close. I mean, not so much now. I learned that when I was in prison. You know, I always hear my family say, you was the glue, and they took the glue away, and the family kind of fell apart once I got convicted. So we started off close. I always remember just always having family time. You know, we stuck together. We fought together. We laughed together. We cried together. We did everything together.
So what was life like for you before you was falsely accused of a crime you didn't do?
Well, life was good. I was in the military. I was, I was a real good sailor. My evals was, you know, one that had unlimited potential. I was getting awards and accommodations. And so right before I got convicted, September 11, 2001 happened. And I was, my mom called and she was asking me, what was I doing? And I'm like, I'm sleeping. And she's like, America's under attack. So I remember, you know, waking up and turning on the TV and seeing the second plane hit. So now my adrenaline is pumping. You know, I was married at the time and I had two young daughters. So, you know, my wife, she's crying, she's scared, and I'm getting ready and like, you know, I have to go. 'Cause I knew I had to report back to my ship. So I reported back to the ship. We was at general quarters, you know, no one knew what was going on at the time. So we was just all kind of just not knowing what to wait for, but we was manning our battle stations ready for anything that was going to happen. So about 3-4 months after that, we deployed to the Persian Gulf. And, you know, we stayed for 7 months. You know, plane guards, planes would go, drop bombs, do all that stuff. I received the Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal because I was the boat coxswain, and I helped save a sailor's life. She had got blown off the carrier, and I drove the boat for about 45 minutes. We searched for her in the dead of night, and we found her. So I got an award for a Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal for helping save her life. And so when I returned from the war zone, you know, I'm thinking life is great. I'm fast tracking. I'm about to be promoted to E6. And then just out of the blue, I was told that I needed to go to a sub base. I was on a ship. They said I needed to go to sub base. And I didn't understand why, like for what reason. No one would even give me an answer. They just said I needed to go over there. So I have this officer and he's with me and I'm still like, what's going on? I have no clue. I mean, absolutely no clue of what's going on. And he said, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but they're going to arrest you when you get over there. And I'm like, arrest me? And I'm like, for what? And he told me they're going to arrest you for sex assault. So now I'm like just confused. I don't even understand what's going on. So we go over there, and there's two detectives. And I respect the detectives because they didn't give me a perp walk. They didn't even really they just patted me down and said, "We're not going to embarrass you. Just turn around, let us pat you down and get in the car." So I got in the car and they was kind of telling me what was going on as I was going to the police station. And I'm still like, I'm not believing it. You know, it's all surreal. You're thinking, you know, how is this even possible? So I bail out after 2 weeks and I was accused of the first degree sex assault of a minor. I knew the complaining witness, but through her mother and through her stepfather. So me and her mother had had a relationship that kind of went sour. So I was just thinking, this has to be the mother trying to get back at me because our relationship went the way it went at the end. But the whole time, I'm still trusting the system. Yeah, I knew that I did nothing wrong, and there would be no evidence that said I did anything wrong. So I was just still kind of confused at why I was even being, you know, charged anything. So I cooperated fully. I spoke to a detective without a lawyer. You know, I did everything that I, you know, they would tell you, hey, if you're innocent, you have nothing to worry about. You just do this and then you'll be okay. So I did everything that they asked of me to do. And I was still charged. And all the way leading up to the actual trial, I had no idea that I could even be convicted. She didn't give a year. She didn't give a she told a story. It was three different stories. Asked when I did it because of my military service. I used to go and travel for 3 months, 6 months at a time. And so I was like, what year did this even happen? They wouldn't even give me a year.
You didn't even know the year that it happened in?
No, they wouldn't even give me a year. So what they did, they charged me. They gave me a 2-year time frame and said, pick a day, pretty much. It was like, I was like, when did it happen? So they gave me a 2-year time period, charged me with one count, and that some kind of reason was good enough to work, I guess. They didn't even give me a year that I allegedly committed the crime. She couldn't say whether it was dark, whether it was daylight, whether it was summertime, whether, you know, it was the week. There was absolutely zero notice of the charge or the time frame.
So let me get this straight. You went from committing a noble and heroic act by saving someone's life to being arrested to acts on a minor, lewd acts on a minor, sexual acts on a minor. How did that make you feel?
It made me feel, I was kind of devastated. And the initial charge didn't really upset me like that, but it was, okay, these people have an axe to grind. You know, I represent and I defend the Constitution, right? I was somebody, like I said, when September 11 happened, you know, I left my family willingly. I left them knowing that I'm finna go over here and fight, and didn't know what was ahead of me, but I knew that I was willing to give the ultimate sacrifice for our country and for the Constitution. So even when I was charged, I leaned on the Constitution that I supported and defended to be there to protect me. And so the initial charge for me was just, oh, these are just people that's mad and got an axe to grind. But I know that this country that I fought for, that I would have gave my life for, that I defended for 10 years, this Constitution is going to protect me. And that's what hurt me the most, is when it ended up not protecting me.
And how old were you at the age of your arrest?
I was about 29 when I got convicted. And to me, that's a good thing because I wasn't young, and it allowed me not to get lost in the system and not to have my thought process, you know, governed by older inmates. So during my trial, you know, I'm still, like I said, I got confidence in this Constitution. I got confidence in what you know, my, like I said, I came from a law and order family. My stepfather, he was a police officer. He was a prison guard. My brother, he was a prison guard. Then he went to the Marines. I was a Navy guy and a military policeman. So we came from, you know, law and order. I didn't see the prejudices that other people see. Like, yeah, I didn't get treated bad. I'm from the South, but I never really experienced the outward racism. So I thought that everything was going to be all right once I went to trial. In my trial, it was kind of a joke of a trial. I couldn't even defend myself. So at the end of the day, the jury heard, she said I did it. I said I didn't. No one gave any testimony to the contrary, and they convicted me off her word. You know, I learned something in the trial.
Let's back up. Let's back up for a minute. I've never been to Hawaii. I want to know about the legal system in Hawaii. Do you think that there are any significant differences over in Hawaii that there are in any other part of the country?
I think it is. And in Hawaii, the reason I think it is everybody's, it's a small island, and everybody, they rub elbows together, and a lot of people don't want to step on toes. So once it goes one way, it goes that way. And people would think that, oh, you're in Hawaii, it's the melting pot, and there's no racism here. But to be honest with you, I've heard the N-word here more than I did growing up in the South of Louisiana. So there's definitely racism everywhere. For people to think, oh, there's all black and brown people everywhere, but it's different when you're black. It's a different standard. And I definitely felt that when I went to the trial. It was just like every other trial. I didn't have not one black person on my jury. You had somebody that was a different race that said I did something. I said I didn't. There was no evidence either which way, and I ended up getting convicted.
It was also no articles. Brooke, who is our research person, she says she's been doing this for a long time, and she's never seen a person who was wrongly convicted get this little coverage in the media. So let's start by you telling us what you know about the crime you were wrongly convicted of.
Yeah, when I was convicted, right? So we go from the force of a trial to the conviction. So upon the conviction, they do me like they did do other defendants. They try to threaten me with 68 years. The prosecutor said, we're going to give you 68 years if you don't, you know, they want you to kind of ask for leniency and all that stuff. And I was like, I don't even care. Like, 1 year, 1 day is too much. You convicted me, so you know, took my life. I still, you know, maintain my innocence. Well, I got sentenced to 20 years in prison. So upon my imprisonment, I learned that the complaining witness had married a guy 5 weeks after I was convicted. He was older than I am.
5 weeks after you were convicted?
5 weeks after I was convicted. She was 16 and he was 29 going on 30. So he was older than me. And she married him.
So, okay, I want to go back some. How long were you in the county? In the county jail?
I was in there probably under. Yeah, I got convicted in August of August 4th, 2003, and in November, I think that's when they gave the judgment. So from August to November.
Were you offering an attorney, or did you ask for one?
I had a public defender during my trial, and I can't say anything bad about the public defender. This guy, it was the judge. She wouldn't let us, she wouldn't let him present evidence. She wouldn't let him ask the relevant questions. And if you go back and read the trial and read everything, you would think that, like, she was definitely for the prosecution side. And, you know, I respect him to the fullest, because even after I got convicted, he came back there and he asked for my mom's number because he wanted to call my mom and tell her himself. And I, like I said, I got so much respect for him going out on the limb, because he didn't have to do it. He could have just walked away and told me the basics. Oh, we'll see you when we see you. But he decided to call my mom himself and told her he was sorry. He did all he could do. So I had a public defender, but I wouldn't put my conviction on him.
Do you feel like he represented you to the best of his ability?
Yeah, I do. I do feel like he did that. But I feel like the judge, she had it out for me. I'll give you a for instance. So my public defender is asking the complaining witness. He's like, you know, asking the questions about dates. And because the reason for this 2-year time period is because she allegedly couldn't remember dates. So he asked her when she talked to a detective, and he gave her a date, and she said, no, that wasn't the date. And he tried to give her the date again, and she corrected him again, and she gave him the exact date. So I called him back and I said, you know, how can she remember this date, something that happened 2 years ago, but she can't even remember a year that this allegedly happened? So he was like, that's a good point. He went back and he began to ask her about it, and the judge stopped him and brought him to the bench and said, don't ask her about being good with certain dates and not other dates, because it's inappropriate. So it's like, there's nothing I could do.
And why do you think there was so little coverage about you and your case of wrongful conviction?
Well, because, I mean, just only today is when they just filed the actual judgment that overturned my conviction, right? Today. And I told you how I did 6.5 years on parole. The coverage, usually when a military guy gets in trouble in Hawaii, they post it on the news. It's all over the news. I don't care what you did. If you're in the military and you have a felony, they're going to put you on TV somewhere. But there was no coverage in my case. It's like, it happens to so many people. If it's not high profile, it's easy to take somebody off the streets and give it no coverage. And then the only people who are fighting for him are the people that's in his family. And if they don't have the means to help or to hire the right people, then you just become a number. And you sit back and you, just like I was snatched off the streets, out of my military role, and I was placed in prison. No one knew about me, so no one was checking on me. And I just became a number in the system. And I'm pretty sure you know, you could scream as loud as you want, but if no one's listening, no one's listening. Mm-hmm. It's not going to help your situation. And I think in my case, because of the lack of evidence, because if they brought media attention to what they did to me, someone would ask some questions. And once the questions get asked, then the whole case would unravel like it did in due time.
How long did your trial last?
It was 3 days. It was a 3-day trial. I testified at my own trial.
Okay. What evidence was presented?
I mean, there was no evidence with the exception of she said it happened, don't know when it happened, changed the story 3 times, was saved by the prosecution. I got up there, I testified at my own trial, and in the closing arguments, you know, the prosecutor, you know, they had a detective that I went and I spoke with her during the initial investigation. She testified against me, and her testimony was the defendant was cocky and he was arrogant. Yeah, my thing is, I wasn't cocky and arrogant. I just wasn't afraid of you because I know I did nothing wrong. So I go in here and I tell her I did nothing wrong. And the only thing, like, she asked me one question. She said, what if I told you we would have your DNA? Because she said that the complaining witnesses said that when we had sex, I ejaculated on the couch. Well, DNA equals game over. So the detective said, what if I tell you we have your DNA? And I said, I would tell you that you're a damn lie, because I know you don't have my DNA, because it's not there. And so when she testified at trial, She said I was cocky and I was arrogant. But my lawyer asked her, why didn't you check the sofa that she said he ejaculated on? She said, well, our paths never crossed. So you got a seasoned detective. You got a witness. Complaining witness said this is what he did, and they don't even go and check to see if there's DNA on the sofa. And her reason for not checking is our paths never crossed.
She said she was cocky and arrogant, but that's still no, that's not grounds for a conviction, a guilty verdict.
And I don't know one guilty guy who is facing 20 years for sex assault, who's not a hardened criminal, who finna lose everything he's worked to amass, who's going to come into a police station cocky and arrogant on a sex assault. I mean, it was just, and to further about this detective, she was a detective that was accused in another case by her partner of falsifying evidence in a murder trial. So she should have never even been on the force.
Is she still on the force?
Well, she ended up being forced to retire. She ended up suing the police, and I think she won like $70,000. She sued them for sexual harassment or some stuff. She was one of those detectives that other judges wouldn't let her testify in their courtroom because she had a credibility issue. But this is the person that they used to testify against me at my trial. So you had her testimony. You had the prosecution at the end of his closing. He was like, everything I had a question for, he had an answer for. The defendant is smooth. He's a player. Don't let him play you. So there was never a got you moment or a look at this evidence moment. It was that at the end of the day, what he asked the jury that I've come to realize in these types of cases is, why would she lie? Mm-hmm. And I couldn't say why would she lie. I didn't understand why would she lie. But I didn't know that that was my burden to prove why somebody would lie on me. And that's what he asked the jury that at the end of the day, when there was no evidence, nobody said they ever saw me do anything. There was no physical evidence. She told the story three different ways. I maintained my innocence. I testified. I went to the police without a lawyer. I did everything they said that an innocent person would do and be all right. But at the end of the day, he asked the jury, why would she lie?
How long did the jury deliberate, and what was your sentence?
Well, they deliberated for 3 days. Well, not 3 days. It was a Friday, late afternoon Friday. So I went home that weekend. That Monday I came in, and it was probably a couple hours, and they found me guilty of all charges, first-degree sex assault and 4 counts of third-degree sex assault. So I was sentenced to 20 years of imprisonment.
And how did you feel?
Oh, when I heard the guilty verdict, I was shocked. You know, I heard my wife, you know, and I heard her let out a cry. And, you know, my kids was in the courtroom. And I was more stunned than anything. Like, it was just like everything is slowing down and you're not hearing stuff. You're hearing echoes. And I'm just asking myself how, and, you know, just, I'm just so confused. I mean, it was more confused than anything. So I stand up and they put the cuffs on me and, you know, they lead me in the back. And once you go in the back, you know, there's no time for feelings. You know what I mean? It's game time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't go in the back crying and all like that. So now I know, you know, I'm in here for this. And, you know, you hear the stories, right? You know, I didn't know anything about it, but I know I'd heard the stories and everybody in the scene, the TV programs and all this. And so I went in the back with my game face on. And with me, you know, when I stand 10 toes down, you know, I don't bend, I don't fold. And I was just going back there defiant the whole time. Like, I was just thinking, well, they're going to have to kill me. You know, I'm not going to go to PC. I'm not going to be bullied and punked out. I'm just going to, whatever happens, happens. And I was so angry at everything, the system. You know, I looked at the, you know, I used to read my military evals and see how, you know, what they said about me, and then to see where I was. And, you know, it was just, I mean, it was just so, I mean, you just can't describe, I mean, you know it. You just can't even understand. You're trying to wrap your head around the whole situation. You can't believe it. But at the same time, you know, you're in a place where if you don't have your game face on, if you get caught slipping, you'll be somebody's victim. So it was just, you know, battling back and forth of allowing yourself to feel and to think and to have your emotions. But then when you walk in to get your child or you walking in the pod, you got to, you know, have this look on your face and have this heightened sense of readiness all the time. And so it was just, you know, just that. And it was, I mean, just knowing my career, everything I worked for, my family, I done lost everything. So, you know, during the prison stint.
Did you believe you was going to beat the case?
At my sentencing, they tried to, the prosecutor said he wanted to sentence me to 68 years. And my attorney told me to testify. So I went up there and I testified, and I didn't back down. And I was like, how could you guys convict me of something that I didn't do? And there's no evidence. And, you know, and the judge was telling me, you know, what she was saying. Oh, there's evidence. I was like, what, her testimony? And I told her, I said, one day I'm going to find some people and they're going to help me and I'll be back. You know, I told the judge that I would be back. And even though I didn't know about the Innocence Project, I didn't know who was going to help me, I just had faith that I was going to be back. So when I went to prison, knowing or believing I was going to beat the case during that moment, that wasn't it. It was, I'm going to do 20 years because I'm not going to take parole. I'm not going to, you know, bow down. I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to do 20 years. And that was my mentality. So when my sentence started, the first year was the hardest. You know, that first year, you're going through it. You're feeling the everything, right? You can't every day feel like a month or something. You know, I was sitting there, and what I used to do is look at the legal form, and I would look at it, and I would be like, man, it's going to ring, and somebody's going to say they made a mistake. You know, they're going to say they made a mistake, you know, every year. I mean, I was like, it got to happen. So I was just looking at the phone for a whole year. I did that. And I found myself, putting myself in bad positions, meaning I was like I was a ticking time bomb. You know, I would jump up and unplug the TV in the middle of the pod if I wanted to watch something and somebody wanted to watch something else. You know how that is in prison, you know, and I got into a few fights, you know. I was in there just, you know, wilding out, just like, you know, people thought I was crazy in there because I was ready to go that far. But what changed me is I got jumped by 11 guys. Like, I got jumped on a basketball court. And I had already had three fights, and, you know, words get out pretty quick, but it was they gang members, so that's how they usually roll. Okay. You know, you know how it is in prison.
I do know how
you
it
got
is.
You got your guys that can handle themselves, but then most gangs, they run in rat packs, so that's how they have to do stuff. But I got jumped by 11, and I didn't have a scratch on me. And when that happened, then I started to realize this isn't about you. You know what I mean? You know, somebody got your back. And I stopped fighting from that moment forward because I knew I was going to be okay. You know, if I'm fighting one guy, I'll figure, you know what I mean? Like, I could hold my own. I don't care how big he is or whatever the case may be. I've always been able to hold my own. But when I got jumped by all them guys and I didn't have one scratch on me, I knew, like, this isn't about you. I mean, you're not that. I'm not Bruce Lee. You know what I mean? I knew I couldn't have done that by myself. So I changed my focus. And I started doing stuff differently. I started living differently. I got into the Bible. I put my hands away and picked up the Bible. And things started changing for me from that moment.
I'm excited to tell you about our sponsor, Pitney Bowes, the industry leader in mailing and shipping. No matter what you send or how often, Pitney Bowes has the perfect sending solution for your business. Weigh, print, mail, and save. They make it easy to save time and money on your office mailing and shipping.
Mail and ship anytime from your home office. Skip waiting in line at the post office. Calculate and print exact postage. Never over or underpay. Select options allow you to compare and choose rates from three major carriers, ensuring you are always using the lowest price available. Did you know that the USPS postage rates just went up in January?
I did, but Pitney Bowes will save you 3 cents on every letter. You'll even get access to USPS retail rate discounts of up to 39% off. Whether you're sending a letter or package or a lot of podcast swag, you'll save time and money with Pitney Bowes. Plans start at just $5 per month. And for our listeners, Pitney Bowes is offering a free trial, so you're sure to find the solution that's right for you and your business. Check out their site to learn more.
Plans start at just $5 per month. And for our listeners, Pitney Bowes is offering a free trial, so you're sure to find the solution that's right for you and your business. Check out their site to learn more. Visit pb.com/actual and try it free. Terms apply. See sites for details.
That's pb.com/actual. And we thank Pitney Bowes for sponsoring the podcast.
Thank you, Pitney Bowes.
The people that I told you, she had got married 5 weeks after I got convicted. Well, mm-hmm. I finally got the Innocence Project in 2006 to take my case.
I have a question. In 2006, how long had you been in when they got on your case?
I was 3 years in. I was 3 years in. I just had my initial appeals. I had just actually lost, I had lost my family, because my first wife, I told her I was going to do 20 years, and it would have been selfish of me to ask her to wait. And I wasn't going to ask her to wait, and she needed to make a move that was best for her and our girls, and I supported her on that. I'm just in there, but, I have a son, and his mom, me and her was always in contact, and she was, she told me about the Innocence Project. She's like, you should check these people out. I'm going to write them, and you should write them too. So she sent me the information. I wrote them, she wrote them, and they ended up taking my case. And my case is kind of it's a difficult case, and there's no DNA. And if you have a non-DNA case, it's so hard to even get someone to listen to you. But I have a non-DNA case with a complaining witness that's not changing their story. So that's even harder for somebody to listen to you about. So the Innocence Project took my case in 2006, and they went to talk to people. Well, the guy she had married, they got a divorce. So he signed a sworn affidavit confirming that he was with her when she was underage. So now that kind of gets the ball rolling. And but the whole time, the Innocence Project, they're doing my case pro se.
All right. What prison did you serve time at? Was you close to home?
Well, I was in Halava. That's in Hawaii. And then I got moved to Mississippi, which was close to my home in Louisiana. My family used to drive down, and then Arizona and back to Hawaii. Well, so while I was in prison, the Innocence Project, they was doing their due diligence. They was working, they was talking to witnesses and things like that. So what got me my break is they used to do it, and they used to have it pro se. So the courts thought it was for me, and they still would deny all my stuff. So I told my team, I was like, they're not going to respect it until you put your name on it. And so they asked me, because it's a non-DNA case, because it's just on credibility, they asked me, would I take a polygraph? So I was like, yeah. And I was in Arizona, and they sent Jack Tremarco. you know, I didn't know who he was at the time, but I know when I met him, he came in and, you know, I went to shake his hand and, you know, his first words to me were, "Do you know who I am?" And I'm like, "No, sir." And he went to, like, he went in on me like, "Hey, don't take this test if you're going to fail it." He's like, "There's other evidence that could get you out. If you take this test and you fail it, then, you know, you're not going to get out. This is going to hurt you." And I was like, "I'm going to pass it, you know." So I ended up taking a polygraph by him. And I passed the polygraph. And if plus four is passing, and I got a plus 10. And after the polygraph, he ended up shaking my hand. And he was like, "This is huge for you." He said, "I've never helped anyone get out of prison, and I look forward to helping you get out." He was like, "This is huge for you." So when I went back to the pod, you know, I call my son's mom, and I'm like, "Look this guy up. Who is this guy? He made me feel funny. Like, I've never been intimidated by a man before, but I could tell that this guy was the truth." So she looked him up and read off some of his stuff, and I was like, "Oh, man, that's why." You know, former FBI agent, you know, he's supposed to be the gold standard of polygraphers. So, you know, I see him on Dr. Phil and all these big-time TV shows because he's supposed to be the best to do it. And so I took the polygraph test. The complaining witness, her ex-husband, wrote a sworn affidavit. Then her mother wrote a sworn affidavit. And so that got, and along with my polygraph, it got me an evidentiary hearing. Well, the complaining witness, she talked to the Innocence Project, and she took a polygraph herself. And when she took a polygraph with Tremarco, she let out something that no one knew at the time. He was questioning her, and she was, you know, kind of laughing and answering questions. And then one part he asked her, he says, "So when he left, did you have sex with him when he moved out?" And you could tell she went to a place even by reading it, but she said, "No." She said, "I hated him for what he did to me, and I hated myself for what I allowed him to do to me." And it seemed so real. Even when I read it, I set the paper down and said, "That sounds too much true." I said, "I'm done now. There's no way I'm going to get out of this." But after I picked the paper up and started reading, Tremarco, being the expert he is, he asked her a question that I don't think anyone would have asked her. He said, "Who are we talking about?" And she stuttered and said, Nate. He said, "Nate, who is Nate?" She said, "My mom's husband. He did the same thing to my sister too." So when she went to take the polygraph to ask, was she in a sexual relationship with me, she slipped and revealed that she was being sexually assaulted by her mom's husband, who had did the same thing to her sister. So armed with this evidence, you know, we go to the Rule 40 hearing. Her stepfather gets on the witness stand and admits to what he did. "Yes, something happened between me and both of the girls." And I'm thinking I'm going to go home right then and there. But they asked me to plead to a misdemeanor. And it's like, wow. How about you plead to a misdemeanor? So I ended up, I'm not taking no deals. I'm not pleading to anything. I ended up walking back to, and that's when I really had a problem with the system, is when they asked me to plead to a misdemeanor after they knew the truth. And I said no. I went back to my cell, and I did another year. And so come up time for parole, I'm not going to get parole. That's what they're telling me. You know, they don't parole innocent guys. They parole reformed guys. And so I was like, I'm not worried about it. I'm not going to parole anyway. But something was telling me, just go talk to him. Go talk to him. So I was like, I'm just going to go talk to the parole board. I didn't have a lawyer. I just went in there by myself. And the parole guy, he was looking at me like, why are we even here? Because he knew I didn't do any programs. You know, he knew that I wasn't supposed to be paroled because I had done nothing. And I said, I just want to tell you my story. And I sat down, I looked him in his eyes, and I told him my story. And he said, after I was done, he said, you know what? I believe you. He said, some people don't belong in prison, and I believe you one of them. And he's like, go get your lawyers and come back. I went, got my lawyers, came back, and I got paroled based on my innocence. And it took 6.5 years.
What year did you make parole?
I paroled on December 1st, 2011.
And you went home that day?
I went home that day, December 1st, 2011. First day out in 8 years, you know, still fighting my case, you know, trying to, you know, just getting out of prison. People don't understand how it is, the culture shock when you go from prison to being outside, when you're afraid to cross the street and you're afraid to be in the car with on the freeway. I mean, it's just a whole bunch of stuff that you have to try to get used to.
So do you still feel that way? Are you still afraid on the highways?
Nah, I'm not afraid now. And it kind of, you know, it took me a little while, but the thing with having young kids, they force you to get in the game. You know, you can't sit back and they want to go. And I have this thing, and it's called, to me, being brave is not the absence of fear, right? I might have been afraid, but I was brave enough to get in there and mix it up. And that's the only way you could kind of get better, if you put yourself in the situations. So I was able to get in there, and you got kids who, you know, their mindset is so young and so focused on what they want to do that they want to go and do. And I didn't want to cheat them out of a father. I didn't want to say, hey, that place got the best of me, so I'm just going to sit back and sit in my room and be afraid to do anything. You know, I'd have been afraid of a lot of things, and I still got it done at the end of the day. So
okay. I'm curious to know this for my own reasons. How long did it take you to get over just the fear or the phobia or whatever you want to call it of riding on the highway? Because I have those certain issues at times. You know, I'm like going over certain bridges, I'm like, man, it's just scary. I don't know how to explain it, but I think you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, it's 2 years today for me, and I still feel that way at times. And I'm just curious to know, how long did it take you to get over that?
Well, I don't even know exactly how long, but it was a while. I used to white knuckle it, meaning I'm just, even like you said, today, if I see another car merging next to me, mm-hmm. I get real nervous about cars merging next to me. And it's like, I don't think it ever really goes away. I just think it's something that you can't let dominate you. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at times we're just going to have to be brave and say, yeah, I'm afraid of this, but it's going to be okay. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's just my take of it. And I think, like I said, with me having young kids, they won't let me sit back, because if I was to sit back and not have to do anything or not have to get involved, then I could entertain my fears a lot more than I do. But I can't even entertain them. They're there and they pop up and stuff pop up. But then it's like, okay, what are you going to do about it? Okay, I know this is the situation. I know I have to do this. And I just put myself in there. It's kind of like double dutch, right? You sit out there and you wait for the perfect time, and you get in there and start jumping around. And that's kind of how you got to do it. It's saying, yeah, I'm afraid, but I'm still going to go through it. You know, I'm going to be brave. And that's kind of what we have to do. And that's what I choose to do. When I got out, the first thing I did was went to the first conference I went to was in Portland. And, you know, I'm fresh out. So, you know, you got kind of this edge with you because you're out. You don't like crowds, right? Crowds make you nervous and people kind of make you nervous. And so the first guy comes up to me, you know, I'm feeling my 8 years. I just got out of prison. I did 8 years. So first guy come up and he's like, hey, bro, how you doing? All right. How long you do? I'm like, 8 years. I'm like, how about you? And he like, 30. And I was like, oh, 30. You know, next guy come up, he like, how long you did? I'm like, 8 years. How about you? 28-20 on death row. So now I'm like, I'm stunned. Like, wow, my 8 years is small compared to these guys. And I'm looking at relative time. So this guy tells me about losing his son when he was in prison. His son committed suicide. And, you know, this stuff is just breaking my heart. So when I left Portland, I wasn't thinking about me. I was thinking about everyone else and how the system seems to, you know, be unfair to minorities and people of low social status. So I was on the airplane and I was angry and I was sitting back and I got my head up against the window. And, you know, guys could either go two ways. You know, they could get bitter and they could start, you know, not helping the cause, or they could get better and help other people. So I was on my way down that angry path when, you know, the guy next to me, you know, I got tapped on the shoulder and somebody handed me a little note and it said, I love you. And it was from a little girl and she was had to be about 4 or 5 years old. And she was sitting across and I was stunned by that. Like, she's a little white girl. I'm a black guy. So I don't look like her uncle, I don't think. And she had to, you know, she saw me and she wasn't afraid because I know I had a look on my face. Instead of her being afraid and thinking I'm a scary man, she decided to send me a note that said, I love you. And so when we got the baggage claim, I wanted to go up to her father and tell her what she did. And when I went up and I was talking to him, she was with her mom and she saw me and she ran over there and gave me the biggest hug. And I mean, I was so stunned that I didn't know what to think or what to do, but I know all that anger went away. And until this day, I got it laminated and I carry that in my wallet every day. Just that little note that says, I love you, from a 4-year-old that I don't even know her name. I got it laminated and I carry it every day of my life. And that tells me that, you know, love conquers hate. So I decided to try to get better and try to help others. And so, you know, I waited, man, the trial, the transcripts. It took the courts a year just to give me the transcripts of my case. A year. After this guy had admitted, the stepfather had admitted that he was messing around with the daughter and the both of the stepdaughters. After the friend and admitted it, they still wanted me to plead to a misdemeanor. And since I did none of that, you know, they drug my case on for the longest. And like I was saying earlier, it's only until today that the order came in and said that I overturned my conviction. It took from 2009. I got my evidentiary hearing. It started in 2010. It's 2018, May, is when the final judgment came in that said the conviction was overturned.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
So how do you think this experience has had an effect on your mental health? Do you think this experience has had an effect on your mental health?
Oh, it's definitely had an effect on my mental health. I mean, I don't know anyone who could go through this and say that it doesn't have an effect. And as for me and other people I talk to, everybody's different. And you look at the mental health aspect of it. And with me, what I try to do is, like, I don't want to be the victim and I don't want to give them that power over me. And I know I have certain issues, like we was talking about. Sometimes things just come up. But I always try to self-assess how you feeling today and what's going on with you today. And having a support system I have, I think it's perfect, because like, you know, and everybody else who've been through that situation knows that you don't need to be smothered. You don't need to be babied. You need what you need when you need it. So I've been able to be in a, I think, the perfect situation to where I can make enough money to provide for my family. I could have the people to understand that, hey, he just needs his own time. He's not tripping, give him his space, or this is what he needs. And I always think about it for myself, because I think one of the biggest things is acknowledging that I can't control the way I feel, right? I may wake up feeling one day, feeling some way one day, but I can control my actions, right? So as soon as people understand that feelings are feelings and you can't control them, but you can control actions, then that's when you start getting better. You know what? I feel bad today, so I'm finna do things that make me happy and kind of switch it up, because you can wallow in it or you don't. And I kind of got that from being inside, because I would think about missing my family and everything, and it would be so depressing. So instead of thinking about how I miss my family, I started telling myself, I'm going to think about what I'm going to do when I see them again. So now that thought is a happy thought. So I just replaced that depressing how I miss them to, oh, when I see them, this is what I'm going to do. So I'm still thinking about them, but I'm thinking about them in a positive way. And like, that's what I do for myself. And I know it works for me. I don't know about others, but I know if I'm just like anybody else, if I chose to sit back and let it consume me, it will. But I know that I can't control the way I feel. And hey, it's okay to feel the way you feel sometimes. Sometimes you need to cry. Sometimes you need to scream and yell. But then at the end of the day, it's okay. I've done that. Now let's move on. You know, what's next? And if you use feelings like that, I don't think they would consume you. But if you sit back and let them consume you, they will.
You have a very positive outlook. So what are you doing right now? What is your relationship with others, and what kind of work do you do?
Well, I work at a shipyard. Was in the Navy, now work at a shipyard that fixes Navy vessels. So I became a supervisor 5 months after I got out of prison. And I've been getting promotions ever since. I've been there for 5 years, 5.5 years. I love the job. You know, they've been supportive. When I went there, I was a parolee, but they didn't judge me based on what the parole thing said. They judged me on my character, the content of my character. And, you know, I still, the military, if it did anything, it taught me military bearing. And, you know, being in dangerous situations, the high-stakes situations where one wrong move and someone could lose a life or you could lose your own life, you know, that taught me to be cool and calm under pressure. And it also taught me to, you know, just to stay focused and stick to the task. So my outlook is always been from my home upbringing, my mom, then the military. You know, I was rough around the edges till I got in the military, and it taught me some military bearing. And, you know, I came, I had a moment in prison to where I had to decide, you know, either I was going to get the living or get the dying. And I chose to get the living. And once I chose to get the living, then you can't let no one. And I made a promise to myself that I never let anyone else dictate the way I feel. Right? No matter what you do to me, I won't let you dictate the way I feel. And that's just how I go about it every day. You know, every day is a different day. It has its challenges. But I surround myself with positive people. I don't find myself, you know, trying to run and relive my glory days or anything like that. I ride with people who are going the same direction I'm going in, so there's no friction. And life is that simple for me. And I live my life by this. If I don't live my life with, is it hard or is it easy or whatever, I say either I can or I can't, or maybe I can. If I can, I will. If I can't, I won't. And if it's maybe, I'm going to give it what I got and live with the results. And that's just how I keep it simple. I keep it real simple like that.
Is there anything you would like to say about your life now, about your family, a career, anything?
Yeah, I just like to say, you know, due to the the Innocence Project, you know, they gave my life back. And for me, my biggest thing is you got, you know, we see minorities and everybody thinks about, oh, it's the man, or, you know, white folks this and white folks that. But when I go to these conferences, when I, you know, see people that's doing the fighting, it's people of the opposite race, and they fighting for you, and they helping you out. When I got granted parole, one of my lawyers is a multimillionaire white guy, and he shed tears, and he cried in there for somebody he didn't know to be released and free. And that just shows me that it's not black versus white. It's wrong versus right. And good people are good people, no matter what color you are. And for my family, I know that they're thankful to the Innocence Project. They're thankful for everybody, not even for on my case, but every case, because it took somebody else's case to get mine overturned. And everybody that's out there that's doing the work, that's helping people out, you're not just helping that person. You're helping everybody else that believes in them and loves in them and care about them. And that's what I want to say about that.
What advice do you have to give to anyone who might be in prison, wrongly convicted for a crime right now? What would you tell them?
I tell them, hey, keep your head up, man. Like, I know, you know, what I was going through when I was in there. Every time I would see somebody get out, I would be happy for them. But then again, I would feel kind of envious because I want my turn. But I never gave up hope. And you guys shouldn't give up hope. And stand on what you believe in. And, you know, pray. Just keep your faith. And never give up. Because if you sit back and you stick to your guns, they could take your body. They can't take your mind. If you have to do whatever you have to do to get out, whatever you have to do, do what's best for you. Because I hear guys saying, I would have took a deal, or I would have did this. And I know guys that's in the project that took deals to get out. I don't fault them for it. Everybody has to do what's best for them in that situation. But as far as when you're in there, study, read yourself. Don't let your life depends on just other people. Get in there, help them out, and don't lose faith, no matter what the situation is.
Now, what can listeners do to help someone who's been wrongly convicted?
I think first, listeners need to understand that this happens more times than not. We need to hold people accountable that's in these positions. You know, usually if it's a police detective or a prosecutor, they already have the prestige and the power. So when they say something, people automatically think that they're telling the truth. As a listener, I would say that you should just make everybody prove what they say. Like, these guys get unchecked power. Once they say it, then that's what people believe it is. Don't just believe anything somebody tell you. Make them prove it. And if you're a listener, you get out there and you spread the word and just understand that I was a military guy. I wasn't on the streets. I was just like a lot of you guys, living my own life, doing my own thing. I didn't put myself in this situation. A lot of people think that you have to be doing something wrong in order for something bad to happen to you. But I'm living proof to tell you that that's not the case. It could be you. It could be your son. It could be your daughters. It could be anybody in your family. And so with that being said, it would be best that we all sit back, pay attention. Don't let someone tell you something. Make them prove it to you.
What advice, if any, could you give to someone such as myself, another exoneree? You know, it's been 2 years. You've been out longer than me. Is there any advice that you can give me?
Yeah, I could tell you that. You know, you have to understand that there's going to be good days and bad days. What I would think for exonerees is, see, what you're doing is so positive, and I've watched how it works, right? Because the PTSD is this. We've been fighting for our life for however long we've been dealing with the situation. And if they take that fight away, what is there left? And that's what people go through. And that's what the anxiety is. Because I'm pretty sure you, me, and most of them that's in there, they're comfortable with the fight. Because I'm fighting for my life. I got nothing else. I have to do this. So once that's taken away, you're left with an emptiness. It's a void. And if you help others, if you pay it forward, if you use your time and your energy wisely, it'll save you from yourself. Because I've seen exonerees that go the whole opposite way. They fill that void with stuff that they shouldn't be filling it with, and they get lost. So if you fill that void, if you don't know what to do with yourself, you have to understand it's because something's missing in your life, and it's something you've been doing for however long. You've been fighting. So just take that, refocus, and pay it forward, because remember how you felt when you were in there and you see other guys get out and go on about their thing. Don't forget the guys. Reach back. Help somebody else out. And in turn, you're going to be helping yourself. Because if you don't, and if you just think you can sit back with idle hands, you're going to find yourself consumed.
That's great advice. And I do remember what it was like in there. And I do try to reach back. That's why, you know, whenever I get some spare change, if I can send some of them guys some green dots or send them some pictures or even a letter, you know, I jump at that chance. And a lot of my guys, they know that I'm not just talking, but, you know, that's great advice. Thank you. And that's pretty much all that I have. If there's anything you want to say, you know, here's the time to say it.
Yeah, I want to say I appreciate you. You know, I appreciate, Brooke, what y'all doing out here, getting the word out. You'll be so surprised at how many people that don't even know what the Innocence Project is. You know, you see people getting out every month, it seems like. But the masses, they don't know who the Innocence Project is. And I say that to all the listeners, and, you know, go out and introduce somebody to it. You know, just pass on the information. And I say let's start holding prosecutors, you know, police detectives, you know, judges, anybody who violates the people's trust. Because at the end of the day, when you go to trial, it's the state or the people versus. And that means they represent you. It doesn't mean that they're above reproach and they can't be, you know, touched. So we need to say, we're giving you this power. We're giving you this authority. We believe you when you sit back and you tell us something. So if we find out that you intentionally lied, you intentionally sent somebody to prison that you shouldn't have, we have to hold them accountable 10 times worse than we'll hold somebody else accountable, because of the public trust that we give and everything we give to them and the prestige. So it's time to change the narrative from, if you're a cop, if you're a judge, if you're a prosecutor, it's going to take, you know, something extraordinary to get you removed or even get you reprimanded. It's time to say, if you are these people, then we trust you more than we trust most. And if we find out that you're abusing that, you're going to pay, and it's going to be a severe penalty.
Hey, man, I appreciate you sitting down telling us your story, because a lot of people do need to hear that. It was an honor to meet you in Memphis this past Innocence Conference, and I hope to see you in Atlanta next year. I'm glad that I did the interview with Rodney to help him get his story out, because when we met and talked in Memphis, he told me that, you know, he wanted to get his story out. And I know what that feels like, because I, too, also want to get my story out. So, you know, I felt need to reach out to him and let him come to the show and tell his story in his own words. And I think he did a great job of doing so. Remember, if you want to hear my full song, there is a link in the show notes, or you can text DSONG to 797979. And hey, remember, the best podcast ever, Buried Alive, is coming out late Sunday night, Eastern Time. Go subscribe now so you don't miss out. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. When she's not on Doctor's Orders to Rest Her Jaw. Our producer is Lisa Strong from the amazing podcast Crime and Precedent. Our transcriptionist is Christina Judge. Our website guru is Sean Cole. Our master of social media is Cameron Taylor. Our amazing volunteer is Casey Weber. Our executive producer is Brooke Giddings. DeMarco song. Y'all check this out. Here it is, DeMarco song.
DeMarco's got a way with people. He can make you feel sublime. He's a natural on the mic, podcasting all the time. And when he gets you on the show, he can pull out your best for sure. It might be a story or a joke. Pretty soon everybody's rolling on the floor. He's the king of Oklahoma, even cooler than Safari Joe. He's a little bit OCD, but that's the very thing that helps our podcast grow. He's got a smile that's contagious and leave you bursting at the seams. And if you ever get the chance to meet him, you'll see exactly what I mean. Musical taste is solid, except for his love for Trapped. And his technology skills and knowledge, well, we're trying to help him out with that. His compassion overflows, and his kindness knows no end. And when it comes to actual innocence, you couldn't ask for a better friend. Yeah, he's the king of Oklahoma, even cooler than Safari Joe. He's a little bit OCD, but that's the very thing that helps our podcast grow. He's got a smile that's contagious and leave you bursting at the seams. And if you ever get the chance to meet him, you'll see exactly what I mean. Safari Joe. He's a little bit OCD, but that's the very thing that helps our podcast grow. He's got a smile that's contagious and it'll leave you bursting at the seams. And if you ever get the chance to meet him, oh, I hope you get the chance to meet him. And if you ever get the chance to meet him, you'll see exactly what I mean.